Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour, Joe Clement. John Nilsson and Patricia Kohlberg have helped co-produce today's show. The Old Mole is a radio zine that comes at you every Monday morning, 9 to 10 a.m., with an hour of interviews, reviews, commentary, music, and different slices of perspective on how we can build a more democratic world that is going to be able to change what needs to be changed so that the Earth does not blow up or burn up. On today's show, Bill Resnick talks with Max Elbaum about the two existential threats facing humanity today, authoritarianism and global roasting. They discuss how to defeat both, building the broadest of lefts that include segments of the Democratic Party that might support the sweeping mobilization of all our productive resources to transform how we produce and consume. Desiree Hellegers is going to be talking with Cager Claybaugh, president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 4 in Vancouver, Washington, about the local and global stakes in the Vancouver Port Commissioner race, where incumbent Eric LeBrant, who has been a longtime opponent of fossil fuel infrastructure at the port, is up against fossil fuel-backed challenger Greg Seifert. And then to round out today's show, I'm going to be talking with labor organizer, educator, and writer Eric Dernbach about the mass quittings and staff shortages affecting the American economy, whether we're seeing what former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich has called a disorganized general strike, and why Eric writes that millions of workers are quitting, they should be organizing. You can listen to today's show in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. You can listen to the whole thing or individual segments, which you can share on your social media. Find us on social media by looking for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and Twitter. Email us with your comments, questions, suggestions, or interest in being on the show at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Now, to start today's show, Bill Resnick and Max Elbaum.
Hi, Max Elbaum. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill.
Max Elbaum has been active in peace, anti-racist, and radical movements since the 1960s. He is the editor of the website Organizing Upgrade and the author of the book Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turned to Lenin, Mao, and Che. Today, we'll be discussing first the two existential threats that we, humanity, and indeed much of planetary life faces. One is Trumpist authoritarianism, and the other is climate change that is accelerating on its way towards climate cataclysm. After that, we'll discuss how can we, and that portion of humanity that thinks that our current economic system, capitalism, has brought us to the brink of political and economic disaster, environmental disaster, how can we defeat the threats? And let me let you in on a secret today. I think that we are building a powerful movement. It includes much of the Democratic Party that we must work with, more on that later, and at some point soon gain the power to create that other necessary, possible, sustainable, and democratic world. First, Max Elbaum, tell us about the threats and how serious are they, and then we can discuss how to defeat both threats, marginalize Trumpism, and rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
The threat of Trumpism, it's been building for many years. We've been in a 40, 50-year backlash against the gains of the 1960s, but it flipped over in the last 4 or 5 years as the reactionary forces in U.S. society, afraid of demographic change and the changing leftward impulses of the new generation, don't think even the rigged system of U.S. democracy, stunted democracies that existed, was going to be enough to sustain their rule. So there's a turn toward authoritarianism, and Trump was the vehicle for that. Behind the big lie about the 2020 election being stolen is a plan on their part to essentially have a coup in 2024. And the combination of voter suppression, legislation that gives more power to state legislatures to ignore whatever the vote was in their state, and other forms of manipulation are underway in as they try to impose what amounts to a neo-apartheid system. And it's no accident that the fossil fuel industry is one of the biggest supporters within the ruling class of the Trumpist bloc that's taken over the Republican Party, because they realize that the mass of people, especially young people, are opposed to their policies, want to see a serious battle against climate change, which means the end of dependence on fossil fuels and a very rapid motion toward renewable energy as the global source of energy, with this country playing an important role in that. Otherwise, the threat of climate change, we face a species catastrophe. The latest report from the UN shows that we do have a window within which we can mitigate some of the worst effects if we move decisively. But if humanity doesn't move decisively, we're going to see climate change is already here. It's already creating many, many problems, especially in the most vulnerable communities. But they will be qualitatively worse if we don't move, ending the dependence on fossil fuels.
Yeah, the UN-sponsored report of the world's climate scientists point out that if we don't do it in 10 years, we're likely to risk the creation of feedback loops so that no matter what humans did, no matter how much they cut their greenhouse gas emissions, warming the tundra and the Siberian permafrost and the Canadian permafrost and others will begin drying up, burning, and creating so much greenhouse gas emissions that the planet becomes uninhabitable over most of it. This is Bill Resnick talking to Max Elbaum, who organizes and writes a lot. Find his work on the website Organizing Upgrade. We've just discussed the great threats that we face in climate roasting and in Trumpist authoritarianism. So, Max, what is to be done? How do we deal with the threats to marginalize Trumpism and take the completely doable steps to stop global warming? How might we in the coming struggles build a contending left party and build left movements? Let's start in the last big election, Trump versus Biden and the congressional election. Some of us argue that the radical left must urge a vote for Biden, indeed maybe work to get out the vote and be quite adamant about that. But comrades on the left say that's folly, it will be disastrous. Tell us what they argue, that is our comrades on the left, that we should not be involved, have nothing to do with the Biden administration, but critique them, and in fact, just work to build the movements. Tell us about them, and how do you respond?
Well, the starting point is what the principal polarization in the country is today. And the main polarization in the country is between the Trumpist bloc, which has taken over the Republican Party and used it for their agenda. It's their political instrument. And their agenda is all wealth to the wealthy, continue the fossil fuel industry, and impose a two-tier, go back to the period of Jim Crow. And the fervor in that section of the population is built up by the sense that the demographics in the country are changing and white Christian America is in danger of civilizational overthrow or the great replacement, as Tucker Carlson puts it, in one of the tropes of the white nationalist, long-term white nationalist movement. And there's a much broader coalition, a majority of people against that agenda, but the majority, the anti-Trump, the anti-authoritarian agenda is divided around what kind of society we should live in. If we do manage to defeat the ethno-nationalists, the white nationalists, and the authoritarians, and it's a broad range. It goes all the way from anti-Trump Republicans to the mainstream of the Democratic Party to the resurgent progressive wing, which was manifested especially in Bernie's campaigns. And then there are various revolutionary and anti-capitalist forces within that progressive bloc. So the country's at an inflection point. Mike Davis called it, we're in trench warfare. It's stalemate between the two sides right now, because although the anti-Trump forces are the majority, the Trumpist bloc is united. They have resources. And because of the skews in the way the system is structured, they control the Supreme Court. They control the state legislatures in a majority of states. And with voter suppression and the racist biases in the Electoral College in the Senate, they have a disproportionate advantage. So if you're going to beat them, you need a combination of strategies that include the electoral arena, protecting the elections, and then implementing an agenda that starts to serve the majority of people and begins to break up the allegiance of some of the sectors to the Trumpist coalition. The idea that you can do that without defeating them electorally is simply a non-starter within the way this country is structured and what the vast majority of people think is how you do politics. So in the 2020 elections, the forces that threw down against Trump had a three-lap strategy, which was defeat Trump electorally, then protect the results, which included mass action in many states, and then fight for a progressive agenda to make sure that the Biden administration would give enough to the working class and the oppressed peoples so that we had something to offer and we could start the country on a new progressive trajectory. That same situation, I think, applies in 2022 and 2024. And the history of revolutionary movements and radical reform movements is that those who gain influence when you're in a period facing authoritarianism or fascism or some variant are those who put themselves forward as the most resolute opponents of that threat and win the most credibility, fight alongside the majority of people who are opposed to it. And those who stand aside from one or another aspect of that struggle get isolated and lose their credibility. So the section of the left that gained in 2020 was the section that threw themselves into the electoral arena, the state power building groups around the country, the unions like Unite Here. They gained influence with the most thoughtful and combative sectors of the working class and communities of color who see Trump as an existential threat. If you stand aside from that and you say it's not good enough, you lose your credibility. It doesn't build the left and it doesn't defeat the right.
Some of our comrades, though, argue a different history than you've pointed out, that every time we get involved with the Democratic Party and get involved in electoral politics, what happens is, and I think, in fact, that sometimes has happened, not this time, but when we do get involved in elections and endorse a Democrat or even work for him, we get passionately involved in the results of the election and go along with this least common denominator politics that don't frighten the middle sectors of the electorate who are sort of independent and go either way. And ultimately, we lose our own political identity and we lose our capacity to influence others. My sense is that we can be autonomous from the party and especially the party elites and do not have to give up our politics, but at the same time, struggle against authoritarianism and struggle for a climate policy that's equal to the threat. Hi, folks. This is Bill Resnick talking to Max Elbaum, who has been active in peace, anti-racist, radical movements since the 60s. He organizes, he writes. You can find his work on the website Organizing Upgrade. And we've just discussed the great threats that we face in climate roasting and in Trumpist authoritarianism, and also how we must work in politics with the Democrats to keep the radical right from power, but of course work with them in ways that we don't lose our economy or our political visions. So Max Elbaum, that's just part of the battle. The other part is building movements, perhaps not identifying themselves as socialists, but movements that fight for changes in policy and the rules of the game, how we deal with the environment, how we ensure that workers at every level gain a family wage, how we stop global warming, as well as now an arms race with China that the military-industrial complex is ginning up. What do you see as the left role in organizing, especially when a majority of the radical left that seems to me work with and organizations that fight global warming? We're working in, it seems to me, every area of combat in U.S. politics. Do you see that kind of work working in those movements as important?
Absolutely. Rebuilding the labor movement, strengthening the institutional strength and militancy of the anti-racist movements. You mentioned the war with China, the threats of that conflict right now, the struggle for peace. That's our weakest area in terms of the progressive movements. And it's our area of the biggest conflict that we have with the Biden administration. Because on almost all the so-called domestic issues, the Biden administration has made concessions to the left. But part of the reasons they're making those concessions is they want to retain U.S. global hegemony, and they're even advertising and trying to promote some of the positive domestic changes on the grounds that it'll put us in a better position to have a conflict with China. We'll have more soft power in the world, we'll be stronger and all that. So we have some bitter fights ahead, and we're not going to hold elected officials accountable. We're not going to be able to get what we need programmatically solely through the electoral process. We have to push. And that takes social movements. We're talking now in October. There's a strike wave going on. There's all kinds of formal and informal worker militancy right now. There have been a spate of articles in the last few weeks about the number of workers who are just quitting and walking off their job, basically going on strike, of unorganized workers. They don't have union representation, but they're fed up. And labor has some bargaining power that it didn't have previously. So every one of these movements has to be expanded, has to find ways to both broaden as well as connect with one another and find a way to use some of the influence that was gained. I mean, a lot of the left turned to electoral politics, partly out of the need to defeat the right, but the other motivation was that some of the traditional institutional structures of the left were not able to get to scale. And the labor movement is traditionally the main site because that brings people together across racial lines, across other socioeconomic lines. But the labor movement was not in a position to play the kind of role that, of course, people on the left who have working class politics wanted to play. And the electoral arena pushes you in the direction of trying to make connections and find coalition because you have to have a program that can appeal to the majority of people in your district. But that's not a panacea. That's just one front that we have to engage in. So rebuilding the social movements, I mean, we have a lot to learn. You mentioned a number of the important groups fighting on those issues, the Sunrise Movement, the sit-in that they did at Pelosi's office that AOC supported, that changed the dynamic around climate change. You know, all of that is absolutely necessary. The fight in Alabama, beginning the unionization of Amazon. There's a big Teamster election going on right now. And one of the issues is, will the Teamsters throw down and be involved in organizing Amazon? So, you know, the head of Amazon is not a friend of the Trump administration, but he's not a friend of the working class either. So I'm optimistic too. Bill and I grew up about 10 blocks from each other. So maybe there was something in the Milwaukee air that gave us both this hope. We also lived through the time where there were huge, Bill and I were talking just before the show, Alice Chalmers, A. L. Smith, places that employed 10,000 workers at a time. I worked at a forklift place. Bill worked in a steel place. You know, you got to see the potential power of the working class and grew up in a time when of optimism, the utopianism of the 60s. So that's imprinted on us from our generation. But we don't underestimate how tough it's going to be. Our enemies are ruthless, and not just our enemies in the Trumpist camp. So we have to learn to play the hardball politics. It's, you know, it's a messy game. There's no guarantees, but you fight and you make a difference in people's lives. And if you persist, the moral arc of the universe will bend your way, but it doesn't bend by itself.
Hey, and doing that fighting is fulfilling and pleasurable of itself. What else should we be doing nowadays in this imperiled world? And feeling solidarity with so many people. Max Elbaum, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill. Nice to talk about Milwaukee and the class struggle. What could be better?
I'll sing you this October song. Oh, there is no song before it. The words and tune are none of my own, for my joys and sorrows bore it. Beside the sea, though brambly briars in the still off evening, birds fly out behind the sun, and with them I'll be leaving.
the fallen leaves that jewel the ground. They know the art of dying and leave with joy their glad gold hearts in the scarlet shadows lying. When hunger calls my footsteps home, the morning follows after. I swim the seas within my mind, and the pine trees laugh green laughter. I used to search for happiness, and I used to follow pleasure. But I found a door behind my mind, and that's the greatest treasure. For rulers like to lay down laws, and rebels like to break them. And the poor priests like to walk in chains, and God likes to forsake them. I met a man whose name was Time, and he said I must be going. But just how long ago that was, I have no way of knowing. Sometimes I want to murder time. Sometimes when my heart's aching, but mostly I just stroll along the path that he is taking.
That was October Song by the Incredible String Band. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. Before that, Bill Resnick was talking with Max Elbaum about the twin existential threats facing humanity, authoritarianism, and global warming. They discussed how to try and defeat both by building coalitions and even including parts of the Democratic Party that might serve the immediate needs of working people and the possibility of deeper organizing. Pivoting from that, Desiree Helliger's up next talks with Cager Claybaugh, president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 4 across the river in Vancouver, Washington. They're going to be talking about the local and global stakes in the Vancouver Port Commissioner race, where the incumbent, Eric LeBrant, who has a record of opposing fossil fuel infrastructure in the port, is up against a challenger backed by fossil fuel interests named Greg Seifert. They're really putting into practice some of what just Bill and Max were talking about as far as coalition building and the breakdown of seeming political barriers between segments of the working class of the broader community. Desiree?
I'm speaking today with Cager Claybaugh about the race for Vancouver Port Commissioner, which has current Port Commissioner Eric LeBrant facing off against Greg Seifert. Cager Claybaugh is president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 4 in Vancouver, Washington. He served 8 non-consecutive years in the position. He's a third-generation union longshoreman at the Port of Vancouver in his 27th year in the union. He's a lifelong resident of Clark County. So this race doesn't seem to be getting a fraction of the attention it deserves, given that it has potentially global impact in a region that's been hammered over the past decade by fossil fuel companies bent on transforming the region into a toxic fossil fuel transport corridor. West Coast ports we know are strategically important as exit points for oil and gas coming from the Bakken in North Dakota, coal from the Powder River Basin of Montana and Wyoming, and oil from the Alberta tar sands. So can you talk a little bit about why this election is so critical, what you think our listeners most need to know?
I've been going to Port Commission meeting since the late 90s. Back when I started going, there wasn't a whole lot of going on. They would talk about equipment to buy, you know, where they wanted to spend a little bit of money here and there to make the port a little bit better as far as infrastructure. And it just kind of went that way for a while. And then, you know, fossil fuel companies became interested in the port. And we saw what happened with Tesoro. The reason that Eric's race is so important is we had to do a lot of work to make sure that that oil terminal wasn't built that Tesoro was proposing. All of a sudden, we're in the crosshairs.
And we're talking about an oil terminal that would have been the largest oil terminal in North America.
Yeah, that's what they say. I mean, when they say 360,000 barrels a day is going to go through your port, what does that mean? I mean, I can't equate that. I don't know what that looks like until you start seeing what 360,000 barrels of oil looks like in a train, right? We did everything we could to make sure that that oil terminal didn't happen. Obviously, one of the reasons was safety and the fact that the company coming in could care less if they got their trains from point A to point B safely. We're going to be working next to those railroad tracks. You know, we don't want to get killed, plain and simple. We don't want to see anything happen to our river. So we knew at that point that we had to take a stand. And part of that stand was making sure that we had representation on the Port Commission that would listen to us and listen to the community. So going back to my over two decades of going to Port Commission meetings, you know, back in the old days when you had Bob Mosier and Byron Hankey and Arch Miller, you know, on the commission, you know, those guys did a good job. It was actually a very rounded commission, I thought. And everybody got along. And, you know, Arch Miller's a diehard Republican, of course, and doesn't have a lot of good things to say about unions. Of course, I'm a diehard liberal, don't have a lot of good things to say about conservatives. But we're able to look at each other's points of view, right? Well, as the commission evolved, you know, you had Nancy Baker get elected, first woman commissioner at the Port of Vancouver. You had Brian Wolf get elected. And then because of them trying to pass the IDD levy, you had Arch Miller get defeated by Jerry Oliver. So at that point, I kind of feel like we had all right. I mean, some all right commissioners that would listen. But for whatever reason, when they started talking about the oil terminal, their ears were closed. They did not want to hear from anybody that opposed it. I mean, when I would go to these Port Commission meetings, they would last maybe 45 minutes, right? Once they had decided that they were going to try to put the nation's largest oil export terminal in, suddenly the comment period was 2 hours long, right? And why was that? We had to make a show that not only the labor in the port, the members of the community, and it, as well as the environmental community, we had to show to them that we didn't want this. But that wasn't good enough. We had to do it every time they met, every single time they met. Why? Because when you stop showing up, then they think, oh, well, they must be all right with it. I mean, that's literally their thinking as far as I could see. So we worked hard and to make sure that we got people elected that were going to listen to us. Now, all three of those port commissioners that I last mentioned, which would be Baker, Oliver, and Wolf, they all didn't seek re-election, right? And the reason they didn't is because they were going to get defeated horribly. They would have been embarrassed. I think that as an incumbent, they would have lost worse than the people that were running against, you know, Eric LeBrant and Don Orange and Jack Berkman. I mean, it was really going to be a shellacking. That's why they didn't run. Truth was, they didn't listen to the community. They didn't listen to the people that got them elected in the first place, and they knew it was going to get taken out on them. So when you talk about what's the importance of this, we don't want to go through that again. If Eric were to lose, we might be all right for a couple of years. We'd have Don Orange on there. We'd have Jack Berkman on there. But then it'd be all hands on deck the next time these guys were up for election. So let's just, you know, keep up the momentum. Let's continue to remind people why we elected Eric LeBrant in the first place. And that is, he listens to us. I've had good relationships with the past port commissioners. But, you know, Eric and Don Orange and even Jack Berkman, it's refreshing to have them on there because they call you and they ask how you're doing. Ask if there's anything you need. You know, Nancy Baker used to do that. Some until we opposed the oil terminal, then those phone calls stopped. Those people were our friends in the past. And I don't want to forget that they did do some good at some point. But, you know, when you get blinded by dollar signs, that's when you got to be removed. And our longshore union's got a really good history of standing up and doing the right thing. And, you know, we were proud to stand with the community. We were more than happy. And actually, I was proud to stand with the environmental community. I think one of the things I'll remember from that race the most was The second we found out that Tesoro was planning on coming into the Port of Vancouver, our local took a vote to oppose the oil terminal, and it passed unanimously. Now, we would have benefited from that coming in. We would have got work there. We would have. But, you know, like I've said forever, the risk, you know, outweighs the reward by a lot. Anyway, we went to the Port Commission meeting, and I stood up and went on record as saying that. And I think one of the most memorable things for me was we were able to come out against the oil terminal before Riverkeepers did. You know, when we came out, I guess the Riverkeepers were actually in that meeting. Luckily, we got to speak first. You know, they about give themselves whiplash when they turned around to look at us when we said that we oppose the oil terminal. And that actually started what I think is a really good relationship with Riverkeepers and the environmental community. Trying to make it sound like a, you know, such a horrible word, environmentalists, oh, you horrible people, you know, chaining yourselves to trees. It's like, yeah, I mean, yeah, there's some people that do that. Hey, whatever, I'm fine with that too. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, hey, I want clean water to swim in, you know. I like to hunt. I know that animals aren't going to be around if they don't have someplace where they can live and, you know, prosper. So everybody needs water. I think everybody needs woods. And all these, you know, say, oh, environmentalists are horrible. It's like, if you sat down and talked to them, you know, I think they'd understand that, yeah, they're probably environmentalists too.
If the port were to have this major, you know, fossil fuel infrastructure coming in, that would basically be not just competing with, but basically overriding a completely different view of, you know, what the Vancouver waterfront would end up looking like, the kinds of jobs that the Vancouver waterfront would be supporting. Is that pretty accurate? And I just want to note, too, that it looks like Seaford has about twice the funding that Eric LeBrant has, and, you know, raising questions about how much of that funding is coming from out of the region.
I mean, you look at every race that's been, you know, the last three races, you know, out of state, you know, fossil fuel money has been poured into these races, and they got their asses kicked. I mean, horribly, embarrassingly. They can throw all the money they want into it, but what we have is bodies that we get out on the street to remind people, hey, this is who we're voting for, and this is why. We can do is to help is to, you know, do what we do, which is talk to our neighbors and remind them this is who we're voting for and why. Eric LeBrant, in my mind, it's a no-brainer. So you got that Greg
Seaford.
Seaford. Okay. And the reason I don't know who he is, he's never called me, right? I'm president of the Longshore Union in Vancouver. You know, you think that somebody running for Port Commission would want to reach out to the Longshore Union. He never did. You know, and we know why, because he knows he's not going to probably get supported from us. You know, that's one of the things, though, Jerry Oliver, I'm sure he knew, you know, he was very anti-labor, anti-union. He knew he wasn't going to get our endorsement, but he would sit down and talk to us and at least try. You know, he wouldn't lie. He'd answer the questions. You know, some of the things I'm hearing about Seaford, the way he answers questions, they ask him, are you in favor of the oil terminal? You know, he doesn't say that he is. He says stuff like, well, it was a missed opportunity. Well, there was no opportunity there as far as I'm concerned.
Raising the question of opportunity for what and how would that vision for the port have basically eliminated a whole range of other kinds of jobs, right?
Right. Right. And you know, I think one of the things he's running on is, you know, he's saying that he wants to do great things at the lake. But I don't see how somebody who wants to do great things at the lake would be in favor of putting the world's or the nation's largest oil export terminal right next to it. I think somebody said, I don't know if it was him or somebody else, you know, they wanted to widen the Flushing Channel to 1,000 feet and use the lake as some kind of marina or something like that. You know, I don't know if anybody's been in Vancouver Lake, but parts I've been to are like a foot and a half deep. So I don't know what those plans are or where that even comes from. It's pretty telling when you see the people who are supporting him. You know, you had Chris Green sign on to him. I mean, that tells me all I need to know, right? The guy that got hundreds of thousands of dollars from Big Oil and Tesoro, right? And he got his ass kicked. Sounds like there's a woman by the name of Ann Donnelly who's an oil and coal lobbyist, you know, signed on as supporting him. I mean, the more do you need to know? Just having those two people there tells me he's no environmentalist and more than likely not a fan of labor. He hasn't reached that out to us.
And, you know, longshoremen are the ones who are going to be moving all the freight, moving all the product, you know, risking your lives if things go up in flames, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've been quite public about the safety issues involved in if there was an oil explosion. The problem of fighting an oil explosion is that it really can't be done. Is that right? I mean,
well, not that I've seen. I mean, it's always what? Stand back and try to contain it if you can. I mean, when the thing in Mosier happened, they just, there was, you know, there was no offense there. It was all defense, you know, try to keep the flames and the fire from spreading to the trees, you know. And the problem we all really had with the oil terminal was, you know, one spill shuts down the whole river. And you can't stop the water from flowing downstream. And it gets in the, you know, I don't know if you've ever been out on the jetty. I have. I've fished from there. And I know that if oil got in the jetty, you'd never clean it up. You just never could. It would be that way forever. So, and that's really one of the best things about Eric is he understands that, you know, it's not just environmental, it's safety as well. It's the bigger picture when you're looking at the local economy, right? When the river shut down, there's no ships coming up. There's no ships going down. You know, people aren't working. One of the meetings that I have attended quite regularly, the Pacific Northwest Waterways Association, which is, you know, kind of a group of all the people that do business in the Pacific Northwest on the rivers and in the Sound. You know, they say that one in three jobs in Washington is connected to, you know, the import and export of goods, right? So if we can't get goods up and down the Columbia River, what do you think it's going to do to our economy here? We need to make sure that not only do we get Eric LeBrant reelected, but, you know, we need to start focusing on getting other people elected as well. They'll, you know, make the stand that needs to be taken. And that's really what I like about Eric LeBrant at the port is, you know, he asks good questions at the Port Commission meetings. He looks at it from labor standpoint. He looks at it from an economic standpoint. He looks at it, you know, from an environmental standpoint. They say that you can't balance the two, but you can. You know, I'm perfectly fine with not having an oil terminal. Right now, what's keeping us afloat and keeping us busy at the Port of Vancouver and has for the last, you know, 2 years has been wind components, you know, windmill blades, windmill towers, generators, you name it. I mean, we've, you know, the whole river has had ships packed with wind energy, just laying at anchor, waiting for a berth so we can get in and unload this stuff. And, you know, people say there needs to be a balance between, you know, fossil fuel and wind energy, and that's not true. There does not need to be any balance. You know, wind energy, you know, when was the last time you heard about a wind spill, right? Never. They try to say, oh, well, you know, but the blades, they have to be replaced and they're fiberglass and they're horrible for the environment. You know, they get, whatever happens to them, they get busted up or buried or whatever. Like, well, okay, I'll take that over an oil spill any day.
So my guest today has been Cadric Claybaugh, president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 4 in Vancouver, Washington. We've been talking about the race for the Vancouver Port Commissioner's position, and that election is, I think, on November 2nd. Cadric, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this has been Desiree Hellinger for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was a song that I wrote for KBOO. If you have not become a member of this station, you can join at kboo.fm/give. Before that, we heard Desiree Hellegers talking with Cadric Claybaugh, president of the ILWU, International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union, Local 4, across the river in Vancouver, where they are having a race over the port commissioner's seat. It is a matter of fossil fuel interests trying to install their candidate so that they can get infrastructure that they want to move their fossil fuel products that are getting tied up because of resistance movements blocking this infrastructure. And how the ILWU built relationships with partners that traditionally, or for a long time anyway, have had some sort of political difference with the perceived interests of organized labor, and how they joined forces, or are joining forces, to oppose this candidate and what he represents for the region. Bill Resnick and Max Elbaum commented on the quit wave that is affecting America and Striketober, and that brings us to the other aspect of left power that we need to rebuild, and that is power that exists in the fact that the majority of us are working class, and the majority of us are making things happen, and if we aren't showing up or aren't making things happen, then the bosses and the owning classes all have something to worry about. And that is why I brought Eric Dernbach on the show to talk about an article he wrote for Organizing Work called Millions of Workers Are Quitting, They Should Be Organizing. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole, Eric Dernbach.
Great to be here, Joe. Thank you.
So you wrote an article for the publication Organizing Work, which we've talked about on The Old Mole before, about how millions of workers are quitting their jobs and they should be organizing. Just before we jump into our conversation about the Great Resignation and the quit waves, could you just say a bit about your involvement with the labor movement and what you're doing with it today?
Yes, my name is Eric Dernbach, he, him pronouns, based in New York City. And I have been a union researcher and campaigner and organizer for a few different unions for the last 20 years. Kind of got my start in the labor movement in the 1990s when I was a grad student at University of Michigan, and I was heavily involved with the Teaching Assistants Union, or the Graduate Student Instructors Union, as we called it, for about 5 years, including being president of the local when we went on strike and bargained what I think was the best contract in our union's history. And I really took a lot of lessons about kind of real democratic, militant rank and file unionism from that, and try to hold on to that over the years. And I'm also a member of the IWW and DSA, and just supportive of workers organizing in a lot of different ways and formats. And, you know, because I'm a labor nerd also, I tend to like to look at a lot of labor data, whether it's strikes and elections. We'll talk about some of that today, just to kind of figure out what's going on with workers these days and how we can help folks organize.
So the Great Resignation is what some people are calling this phenomenon of workers both quitting and being hard to rehire across the American economy. Could you say a bit about what the data says?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we recognize that the pandemic has thrown the labor workforce into a lot of turmoil over the last year and a half at this point. At the beginning of the pandemic, you know, unemployment went up to 15%. As a lot of folks were laid off, and like huge sections of the economy basically had to shut down in order to control the pandemic. And now, you know, unemployment has been creeping back down. Now it's about 5% as folks have been returning to the workforce. But I think we're seeing something really interesting this year, which you're right, they're calling the Great Resignation, which is that record numbers of millions of workers have been quitting their jobs. There's a lot of articles about, you know, what they're calling the Great Resignation, and, you know, a lot of anecdotes. And usually these articles are interviews with employers about how they have a hard time finding workers. And oh no, they've had to raise wages, et cetera. Sometimes there's interviews with workers too. And I took a look at the data, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics has a monthly survey which looks at job openings and quits and layoffs. And you know, it turns out it's this last, I think basically this whole year, we've seen several months that had record-setting quits. Just in August, 4.3 million workers quit their jobs. That was 2.9% of the workforce. And this year, all the months this year up to August, 30 million workers have quit. And it's just a level of quits that just hasn't been seen, I think, since they've been keeping records. And along with that, I think you've noticed too, Joe, it's like a lot of you know, videos and photos online of workers posting signs saying, you know, we've had it and we quit, or the store is closed, or things like that. Oftentimes, you know, I think left Twitter and labor Twitter kind of loves to see that because we're kind of sticking it to the boss. So that's anecdotes, but I think the data is backing that up, that there are a lot of folks just kind of had it, fed up with work and quitting. We can talk about the ramifications for that, but there does seem to be this thing happening this year, yeah.
There's a lot of quitting going on, but especially in the first 6 months of the pandemic and on and off since, there have been massive layoffs too, not to mention the 700, or at least in the first year, 500,000 Americans who died of COVID alone. And then the millions of people who had to go back home to take care of their children. There's a lot of other factors that create this gap that aren't being talked about as much. Why do you think that's the case?
We recognize that this last year and a half has been such a weird and unique situation that I think a lot of folks are still grappling with. What the hell has happened here? I mean, certainly lots of layoffs early in the pandemic. And, you know, there was the, to some extent, support workers that could not go to their jobs because these jobs had to shut down. And then, you know, there was a whole bunch of workers that were able to work from home and kind of discover the benefits of being able to, in many cases, carry out their job on Zoom. I've been lucky enough to be able to work from home this entire time. And then there's a whole bunch of folks that were deemed essential workers that had to show up every day under potentially dangerous circumstances. And as you say, you know, we've had a tremendous death toll, over 700,000 from the pandemic. So many workplaces were not safe enough. Employers did not take it seriously enough. So, you know, the workforce was kind of divided up among essential workers that had to keep going to work, folks that got laid off, folks that were able to continue working from home. And I think, you know, some of the ramifications from all that turmoil are that we have millions of workers that are deciding in their own way that their jobs aren't good enough. They haven't been treated well enough. They're looking for more. And it's partly the reason why we're seeing all this quitting going on.
Some of the arguments that are coming from the especially conservative quarters of the media are blaming government benefits on this, and in some particularly disturbing moments, even suggesting in a very Malthusian mood that if we remove those benefits, then we'll be able to stir economic participation. Is that really holding water?
You're right. There was that one interview where somebody said the quiet part out loud, like we should starve workers like dogs and then they'll go back to work. I think the support that workers were able to get with pandemic assistance, from what I'm reading, it was a factor, not the major one. I think folks have looked at states that had more or less assistance to see if there were major differences in who was working and who wasn't. And there really wasn't that big a difference. First of all, I would say if workers got assistance that allowed them to avoid terrible jobs, then that's great. And we should get more of that. Conservatives hate it. But we want workers to be able to sit out and be picky about jobs and avoid terrible jobs. So to the extent that happened, good, but that's only one factor. There was also childcare issues were hard to arrange. Kids have been in and out of school. A lot of folks are still worried about working in especially customer-facing jobs like restaurants or retail, especially in places where customers are walking around potentially sick and maskless and being really rude to the workers. So working conditions in a lot of industries, particularly lower wage industries, are not good, and they haven't been good for a long time. And I think we have a case now where workers were potentially able to get some assistance. I think I've even seen some data that a lot of workers were able to even save up some money, you know, because I think people like went out less, they spent less money. You know, of course, most of the money saving was done at the higher end of the income scale. But even members of the traditional working class maybe have maybe saved a little bit of money. And so they're able to be pickier about jobs. I think all of that is in the mix, which is all very interesting. And it's why 2021, you know, has contributed to more labor turmoil than we've seen in a long time. Now, on top of all that, and we can talk about this too, Striketober and all of the massive strikes that are going on with unions, a number of major ones going on, other ones being threatened. I think we're seeing more strike activity this year, certainly than last year. And it's also something that labor folks are keeping an eye on.
One of the strikes that is set to go on among Kaiser nurses and healthcare workers really goes to show that wage shortage is not really the whole story here. There are workers in higher paid industries or jobs that also are not wanting to work. There's like 40 to 50% of Kaiser nurses said that they're thinking of quitting, and nurses already make a good amount of money. So there's something else that's coming to a head in all of these quit waves and the problems with hiring workers. And I'm wondering, what are employers trying to do to turn this around? And do you think that they can really offer what workers want?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that wages have crept up, especially at the low end. You know, the Fight for 15 movement started in 2012. And I think at that point, less than half of all workers were making 15 bucks an hour. So we actually hit a milestone in the last month. The average wage in grocery and restaurants, I think, finally went above 15. And 80% of all workers are now making at least 15 an hour. So, and I think part of what we're talking about has led to that. Employers hate to raise wages. We always say that if you have trouble finding workers, raise your wages. Maybe that's basic econ 101. They hate to do it, but they've had to do it. Wages are going up. It is an interesting question you ask about, like, is there anything else employers are doing to entice workers back? I'd love to hear more about that. All I'm really seeing are, you know, articles that come out about mostly employers complaining, as they always do, raising wages, offering bonuses, you know, free meals, other things to entice folks back. Even I think like offering gift cards just to show up for interviews. There's all kinds of ways. It'll be interesting to see kind of how this settles out. And you know, I think once wages are raised, they're hard to reduce again. Wages tend to be sticky. So we certainly are seeing more worker leverage this year as a result of all these quits. And I think, you know, there have been comparisons to all of this as there's kind of an unofficial general strike going on. In other words, that workers are kind of voting with their feet by not wanting to work under these conditions. And I appreciate the sentiments. I think it's a little bit different because we're talking about millions of workers making the individual decision to quit, as they have the right to do, rather than more of a collective effort to strike. But the ramifications of all this quitting, I think, have moved the needle on job conditions in terms of wages are rising. And it'll be interesting to see if other working conditions improve.
You lay it out right there that there is this disconnect between organized collective power on the job to make these changes and then the aggregate effect of individuals making these choices and putting the pressure on management to change something or else they're not going to get workers. Your article focuses on why workers should not be leaning on this market power, but should be leaning on their own labor power, which is kind of being demonstrated in the whole quit wave in a disorganized way. What difference do you think it really makes, that workers should understand that it makes, to apply that power in an organized way and not just walk away from bad job conditions, but change them?
We understand and support if workers have to quit a terrible job. Absolutely. You know, what happens, like workers quit a job and then at some point they have to find another job. And hopefully that next job will be slightly better at slightly higher wages. But really, you know, as I say in the article, we have like kind of a massive round of musical chairs going on. And it would be better, you know, for the working class overall, if more workers decided to stay on the job and organize for improvements. You know, we could talk about like what that means, but I think we have to recognize that, you know, a lot of folks aren't thinking about that because the typical response when workers are unhappy at their job is to quit. And that's usually what people will suggest. If you don't like it, then you just quit. Okay, fine. But there's been examples out there of like whole McDonald's or, you know, Dollar Generals or IHOPs or other stores, like whole shifts of workers walking out. And so we have to wonder what would have happened if instead of 10 workers quitting, they decided to go on strike instead, or they drew up a petition and demanded changes from their boss. The employer would have a hard time replacing them. They probably, in some of these cases, could have won some concessions that would have improved the job. And so then the question is like, how can we, you know, we meaning kind of a labor movement as a whole, teach workers that organizing is an option? Because I think it doesn't occur to a lot of folks. It's not clear how folks can organize or what that looks like. Most people, I think, don't have a clear idea about what a union is or how to form one. There is some interesting data that a lot of folks kind of are interested in unions, which I can talk about. But I think this is the major question we have in this kind of turmoil that we're seeing, where there's a lot of discontent. We need to get into workers' hands in a massive way, the education and the ability to do organizing instead of just quitting. And I think that would be really interesting to do.
I know that you are doing work with the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, which has created a worker organizing kind of tutorial that's one size fits most for workers to then take back to their workplaces. And the traditional goals of like union organizing are to get a contract, to get legal recognition, and to move the needle on your wages and benefits. But what other ways can workers organize to change what their work is like, if not also maybe their pay and other benefits, that doesn't necessarily have to go for that all or nothing kind of arrangement?
First of all, let's talk about what people think about unions. There's some surveys that come out. Gallup does an annual one, and they just came out with their recent data last month, which look at union approvals. They've been asking this question for 60, 70 years. Do people approve of unions? And they found a record 68% approval rating. They say it was their highest approval rating since the 1960s. So, you know, over two-thirds of people approve of the concept of unions. Okay, maybe we're not sure what that means. But another survey from a few years ago basically asked non-union workers, would you like to be in a union? And half of them said yes. You know, there's over 100 million private sector non-union workers in this country. It's a large country. If half of them want to be in a union, that's 50 million workers, 50. A lot of workers. Now, it's not clear to me if most of those folks really understand what it means to join a union or form a union. I think what folks want is they want the better wages, benefits, and working conditions. and a voice on the job and more protections for being arbitrarily fired. Like, they want all those things that they associate with a union job, and it is all true. But it's not clear to folks usually how to form a union or how to organize or what that would even mean. So the labor movement really is failing. It's a massive task, so I don't want to say it's easy. But the labor movement overall is really failing on finding a way to reach out to millions of workers to just on basic organizing education. It's just not easy for folks to just join a union. And you talked about the traditional way of organizing. The traditional way is workers at a workplace would sign authorization cards and file with the government for a union election. You would have your election. Hopefully you win. You probably have to withstand potentially months of union busting, which scares the workers and raises doubt. If you win, then the employer gets dragged to the bargaining table and you hammer out a contract, which can sometimes take over a year. It's a long drawn out process. Unions generally are pretty good at winning elections. And then in maybe half or more of the time they get a contract. So it is a process that I recommend that folks go through if they want to organize a union in the standard way. But it's not the only way to do it. And you're right. I've been volunteering with this thing called EWOC, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. It's a joint project of DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, and the United Electrical Workers. And it was formed at the beginning of the pandemic to just provide education and assistance for workers that wanted to do any kind of organizing around COVID issues or anything else. So I mean, think that the secret that so few workers know is that any group of workers in the workplace that decide to get together and organize and demand improvements, they are acting like a union. They have the legal right to do that. It is not legal to fire them for doing that. It could happen because this is risky and employers will break the law. But that kind of organizing is totally valid. And simply by forming an organizing committee, drawing up a list of demands that a majority of workers feel deeply, bringing that to the boss, and saying, we need these things. Oftentimes, workers will win improvements just by doing that. And I consider that union organizing. It's not official. You don't get recognition. You don't bargain a contract. I think workers can do that eventually if they want to. This is often called solidarity unionism. This is the method of organizing that the industrial workers of the world has done for over 100 years. And it is often successful. But workers, I think, need to know about it. They need to be trained in it. And I think that is the challenge, is how do we spread this information to millions of workers?
That's all the time we have for today. The conversation you just heard is just the first part of a two-part conversation. Tune in next week to hear me and Eric Dernbach talk a bit more about the organizing half of the proposition, Don't Quit, Organize. Thanks to today's guests and contributors, Desiree Hellegers and Cager Claybaugh, talking about resisting fossil fuel infrastructure candidates in the Vancouver Port Commissioner race that's coming up. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Max Elbaum for talking about the importance of building coalitions and thinking of building resilience into our movements. And thanks to John Nilsson and Patricia Kohlberg for helping produce today's show. Find The Old Mole at kboo.fm/oldmole. You can listen to the whole show or individual segments. Our email is oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Tune in next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's radical underground perspective. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.